Podcast in Davis, 90.3 FM.
Thanks, Ramones. This is Dr. Andy of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, coming to you live on a Wednesday afternoon at 5 o'clock. Thanks very much for tuning in to your local campus and community radio station. As your overworked and hyped up, multitasking, multi-hat-wearing host for this particular program, I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to introduce you to two new writers today. The first will be Susan Briante. Susan Briante has a new poetry collection called Utopia Minus. It's forthcoming from Asata Press in March, next month and a half. She's the author of Pioneers in the Study of Motion, a book which C.D. Wright describes as a work of shuddering velocity. She has spent time in Mexico City, and right now she lives in East Dallas, where she is assistant professor of creative writing and literature at the University of Texas at Dallas. In the second half of the program, we'll be joined here live in the studio by Scott Herring. Scott Herring is a lecturer in the university writing program. He's one of my faculty colleagues here at UC Davis. He grew up in Burbank, California, and has spent a good amount of time thinking about, living in, and writing about our national parks. In 2004, he published the book Lines on the Land, Writers, Art, and the National Parks. And he's got some new writing projects, some of which interface with the web and with Yellowstone Park that he's going to tell us about in the second half hour. Also, I'm very excited to say that a week from tonight, on February 2nd, Hannah Block will be the featured poet at the Poetry Night Reading Series. Hannah Block has, for the last 30 years, been a professor at Mills College, where she ran the creative writing program. She's published 4 books of poetry, a great number of translations, as well as books of scholarship. This month, at the meeting of the Modern Language Association, an entire panel was devoted to the work of Hannah Block. She's coming to Davis next Wednesday, the 2nd of February, where she'll be reading at Bistro 33. To find out more about that, you can visit poetryindavis.com. And so, Scott Herring in half an hour, Susan Briante in 5 minutes, and in 7 days, Hannah Block. All sorts of poetical topics, all sorts of important poets coming to you, starting in just a moment, live, here on your favorite poetry and technology program. I speak, of course, of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS, 90.3 FM, Davis. Susan Briante is my first guest. Susan Briante's latest poetry collection, Utopia Minus, is forthcoming from Asata Press in March. She's the author of Pioneers in the Study of Motion. It's a book which C.D. Wright describes as a work of shuddering velocity, an ode, a screed, a lament, a love song. Briante's essays on industrial ruins, abandoned buildings, and cultural memory have appeared in or are forthcoming from Creative Nonfiction, The New Centennial Review, and Rethinking History. A translator, Susan Briante lived in Mexico City from 1991 to 1997, working for the magazine Artes de México and Mandorla. She's currently translating the work of the Uruguayan poet Marosa Di Giorgio. Briante is an assistant professor of creative writing and literature at the University of Texas at Dallas. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to the program. Susan Briante, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you here. And congratulations on the new book coming from Asata Press in March. I think people listening, hearing the title, might have questions. So I'm wondering if you could say something about the phrase and the title, Utopia Minus.
Utopia Minus, it actually comes from a quote by the artist Robert Smithson. Smithson, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but...
I don't think I am.
Excuse me?
I don't think I am.
He's most well known for a piece called Spiral Jetty, which is an earth piece. He actually creates a jetty that makes the form of a spiral in, I believe it's a lake in Utah. But all of his work is very interested and invested in land and landscape. He was a fabulous writer. He really, if you have a chance to pick up his collective writings, he's a great prose writer. And he has a piece which is called A Guide to the Monuments of Passaic, New Jersey. And the phrase Utopia Minus comes from that piece in which he's talking about the suburbs, and he talks about what's lacking in the suburbs. And he's writing in the late 60s, early 70s.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's a particular moment in history of thinking of the suburbs both as a kind of refuge for certain things in the city as well as a place where people went to run away from certain things that were happening in cities. And Smithson said that the suburbs were a place that existed without history, a utopia minus a history.
Oh, interesting.
And that's what I took for the title.
That's great. I like that. So, among other things, he's a land artist. I remember seeing Andy Goldsworthy's land art in Washington, D.C. And we're touching on that a little bit in a technicultural studies class that I'm teaching this quarter here at UC Davis.
Yeah.
So it sounds like an interesting character, Robert Smithson, S-M-I-T-H-S-O-N.
That's correct.
Great. Well, tell me a little bit about your life as a poet and as an academic and as a writer in Dallas, and especially the path that brought you to Dallas and especially your sojourn in Mexico City.
Yeah. I started out on the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And first started working in journalism out of college. I've always been interested in documenting, in investigating. Journalism is a wonderful profession because it's a profession that gives you entry into people's lives. You know,
right.
I don't know of any other profession in which you can walk up to someone and say, let me into your house or where you work. Let me talk to you. Let me see what you do. But journalism is a profession that values, or at least used to, objectivity and sort of precision, right? Sort of naming things as they are now. Poetry is this place of speculation, at least for me. I love poems that not only try to present and document, but also are tentative in how they describe what's happening to and around us. So I started off with a career in journalism in Tulsa and decided that journalism wasn't quite right for me, and spent a year teaching English in Costa Rica, and from there ended up in Mexico City, where I lived a good part of the 90s, working mostly as a translator.
Interesting. And then you left Mexico City in 97, if I remember correctly, from your bio. How did you know that you wanted, in addition to everything else, to move into the world of poetry, and especially to, I guess, the professional world of poetry, which is a difficult leap for a lot of poets to make? There are, thankfully, many more poets than there are professors of poetry. And, but a lot of them would like to be wearing that hat. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, I think that, I mean, I like the way that you make the distinction between poets and professors of poetry. Because we're kind of weird out of the economy little system, the system that we create as poets. And unfortunately, the only way to be paid for being a poet is somehow to be paid for teaching poetry.
Right.
And there are a few people, there are a few exceptions of people who can actually be paid for being a poet without having to teach. And then I think there are many others, me included for a large part of my life, who are writing poetry, although not teaching it in a professional capacity. I think, again, I have always had an interest in learning and reading, so academia and me were a pretty good fit. I also come from the working class, and there's a certain... it felt like a real privilege to be able to actually work at a job which was, in fact, the thing that you love to do,
right.
Something that, in the case of my parents, wasn't available to them. So I worked, I was very focused on really, like, my ideal job being a teaching, a poetry job, a professorship, where my work as a poet would be recognized as part of my job. I don't think that's the best job for every poet, quite frankly. I know a lot of poets who aren't in academia and are quite happy to not be in academia. So, you know, it just happened to be something that that I was looking for, I think, because I had this kind of working class hang-up. And I was fortunate. The universities are undergoing, as I'm sure you realize in California, great changes right now.
Right.
I do feel like I have a great privilege to have my job, but I don't know that it, I wouldn't at all say that it, I mean, I think it's a particular kind of job and a particular kind of relationship you have to have with it. It doesn't necessarily make you a better poet by any stretch of the imagination. I think it can take a lot of people away from the work of poetry.
This is certainly something that Dana Gioia has written about famously in his essay, Can Poetry Matter? Where he lamented the fact that so much of what the quote's best poets were doing reached mostly an esoteric audience of their students and New Yorker readers, I guess, and that poetry should reach out to a greater swath of the American public. And he's said since then that in another kind of an updated essay that he's seen ways that the internet and also the spoken word communities have filled some of those gaps and made and I guess allowed for some of that working class spirit that you were speaking of before make more working class and people are interested in working class people interested in poetry and fine poetry that was accessible to them and that spoke to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking, yeah, I think that the internet has absolutely had an impact on creating audience and creating community, all different kinds of community. And I think that there are, while the internet is a wonderful resource, there are also very active physical communities around reading series in all kinds of different towns, not always associated with university programs that create audiences for poetry. I did my graduate work, or some of my graduate work, in Austin, Texas, which is a very writer-friendly town. And then I moved up here to Dallas, Texas, and I would ask, you know, what's the literary community like in Dallas? And people would say, oh, there's a literary community here. You know, it's this big lament. And actually, there's a very thriving literary community here in Dallas. It's just not necessarily associated with one institution like a university or an MFA program.
Right.
It tends to be community-based or associated with different kinds of organizations. And I'm not saying that that's better or worse than those communities that build that grow up around universities. You have to remember, university isn't the only state where poetry is happening.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's very important. We've got a couple reading series here in the city of Davis, one that takes place, one of my favorites, at a Unitarian church once a month, and then another one that takes place at a downtown restaurant, and then an art gallery, and we have readings at local bookstores.
Yeah.
And none of those is explicitly connected or financially supported by the university. University also offers a great number of poets and readings and speakers and so forth. But it's nice to have that that kind of vibrant intellectual and emotional interchange with interesting and thoughtful writers without it having to be part of an extension of the university itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Susan, we have to take a quick break. When we return, I think folks at home would like to hear a sample or two from your March book, March 2011 book from Asata Press, called Utopia Minus. So if it's all right with you, we'll come back and hear some of your poetry.
That sounds great. Thanks. Great.
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, this is KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis, and you're listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We'll be right back with more of Susan Briante. Stick around.
The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019 or via email at root@lugod.org.
Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. Scott Herring will be joining us in the second half of this program, so stick around for that. And remember that Hannah Block will be reading at Bistro 33 a week from tonight at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow, which will be Thursday the 27th, you might have read about if you're a reader of the Davis Enterprise, the Twilight Mystique will be featured at another Bistro 33 event, this one celebrating a book of essays about the book and film called Twilight and those that came after it. This was edited by two of my colleagues from UC Davis, Amy Clark, who's in the university writing program, and Mary Jane Osborne, who's in the English department. So it's tomorrow at 5:30, The Twilight Mystique at Bistro 33. Susan Briante is here, and she will be coming out with a book this coming March called Utopia Minus. It's from Asata Press, and she is the author of that book, and she's on the live line today from Dallas, Texas. What is the first poem that you'd like to share with us from your new book, Susan?
It's a poem called Better Than Paris, and it's a poem about Dallas, ironically enough. Some of the mentions in the poem reflect the Dallas landscape, although I think it'll be easy for listeners, even those who aren't familiar with Dallas, to follow along.
Great.
This is called Better Than Paris. Good morning. I love you. Late for a meeting. I'm still in bed. Our faces turn to respective cardinal points south. If we are speaking only of heritage, degrees of melatonin. Architecture shapes the body. No matter the square footage, I feel a thin frame around me. A 1920s duplex, a thin white border, as in old photographs around this middle-class winter. I watch a shopping bag gallop down Ross Avenue like some badass cat. Last night, looking for a parking space near the Dallas Public Library, I got lost. Turned right past orange construction barrels, corporate headquarters, county commissions, convention centers. Turned circles in a downtown built in the late 1970s on the scale of a capital city in some developing country. Launched like a wind-tossed plastic bag into a future at the furthest end of an uninterrupted plaza. Door after glass door, not a cop, not a vagrant in sight. At the ruins of Pompeii, Melville writes, like any other town, all the same whether one be dead or alive, Pompeii, comfortable sermon. Last night, I dreamt I held a stone with an oyster shell surface, some artifact of the soul. 5 years the stone shell gave me, existentially, perhaps geographically. Perhaps I should stop worrying about my IRA. Melville liked Pompeii better than Paris. The Germans have a word for this feeling, walking across an interminably long space, this feeling that we will never arrive at our destination. Plot Earth. I watch a gray dove walk across Ross Avenue in full morning traffic. If it's gray, I call it a pigeon, even here in Texas, walking across Ross Avenue as if it didn't have a wing to its name.
That's very nice.
I do like it.
That was Susan Briante reading from her forthcoming book, Utopia Minus. Tell us again the title, Susan.
The title of that poem, Better Than Paris.
Wonderful. And when you think of your own preparations to fill this new book of poetry or the work that you did in your last book titled Pioneers in the Study of Motion, who do you see as influences or as kind of foundational, educational, or MFA-like moments that gave you the confidence and experience and know-how that you needed to publish your first books of poetry?
Gosh, I don't know that I have the confidence or the experience or the know-how.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, or I don't know that one ever feels like it has, that they have all of those things, right?
Right.
I think less than thinking about whether or not one has the experience, and if there's some certain set of, I mean, it'd be wonderful, right, if we could, like, list it, there'd be a checklist of things we would have to have done in order to have written our first book or our second book or any book, but I think those things are different for different people. I think in the case of both my books, what I had were spheres of interest or certain obsessions, topical things that I was thinking about or experiencing in my life. And then I had a aesthetic problem I was trying to solve, something that I was trying to figure out that helped to motivate me through the writing of the book. And it was those things that helped me think about what were the writers, who were the writers I could learn from, or what were the skills I wanted to pick up.
Right. And are there certain poets in particular who were either important to you or that you might want to direct our listeners into investigating?
Those are tough questions, right? Because it's like, who do you leave out?
Right.
I would encourage your readers to read as broadly and with as much excitement and passion as they can, and find whatever book they discarded 5 years ago passionately and pick it up and see what happens. Certainly the work of contemporary poets such as Rosemary Walthrop, C.D. Wright, Roberto Tejada, were people who I felt like I learned tricks from. I mean, tricks is a cheap way of saying it, but I learned something about how language works from reading their work. Charles Olson is someone who you could spend a lifetime reading and arguing with in your head. People should be reading Gerard Manley Hopkins and Emily Dickinson because of their care towards the language in terms of sound qualities. I mean, once a month at minimum. there's so many more, And I think each book or each problem you come up with is going to generate its own list of writers. But let me stop there and see if that's good enough for now.
That's a great place to start. And how wonderful, as you were saying towards the top of the hour, that the opportunity to think about those poets, to respond to those poets' work with our own poems, and also, and for me especially, to share them with students and to guide them into new discoveries and revelations and inspirations really makes me also feel privileged to get to work with the written word in a classroom, and especially with individual poems themselves.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think when we're students, we have to, and when you're a student, and you get this like menu of poets or poems placed in front of you, I felt like, especially when I was really struggling to figure out what my voice was, I was so opinionated, like, don't like that, like this,
Right.
Maybe there's a moment when you need to feel like that, but I do think it's important, even if our professor or our friend or, someone making us read something that we feel less than excited about, it's important to ask ourselves why, and to also ask why are those writers being valued in another way, because you can learn as much from things you dislike as from what you like. And often it's what work that you seem to dislike at one moment isn't speaking to you because it's not helping you answer some question that particular moment. And later on you'll think, oh gosh, how could I have gone this long without fully appreciating X or Y or Z?
Right. And it might be, too, that it's not only what questions are being answered, but for a lot of our students, we're not ready to ask those questions yet. It might be that we're not mature enough, that we have different sort of concerns. But you never know the extent to which a well-placed poem might offer some wisdom in an unexpected way, or some emotional guidance for a student who years later will be making important decisions about her life. And she can reflect on something that she was forced to read unbidden, and it came back to help.
Or those books that we buy that we don't quite get to for years, and if you're like me and you think on a budget, you think, oh, I shouldn't have bought that book. I'm not reading it. And then it suddenly just speaks to you. You pick it up for the fifth time and you start reading it and you can't put it down. You know, I think people talk about their iPod, sometimes knowing what moods they're in. If you put your iPod on shuffle or your iPhone music on shuffle,
right.
Oh, my God, it's playing just the songs I wanted to hear. I think our book buying, like there's a collective library out there that's like that for sometimes too. You might buy a book and it'll sit around for a while before you ever figure out why it's there, and then suddenly it opens up for you in this whole new way.
Absolutely. Well, it's good advice then to go ahead and buy that book that you're thinking
about.
Buy
those books. Yeah.
Especially if it's a book of poetry. Someone will appreciate it. It won't only be you. Well, Susan, this has been a pleasure. I wish you great luck and good sales on your new book of poetry, which is called Utopia Minus from Asata Press. And I really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to join me on KDBS.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, folks, you're listening to Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS. Stick around because in addition to a public service announcement or two, I have my colleague here at UC Davis, faculty member, author, and lover of the outdoors, Scott Herring. He's here in the studios and he's going to be joining us in just a moment here on Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour. This is Dr. Andy with an important message from the Merchants National Bank of Sacramento. The Merchants National Bank of Sacramento is proud to join the 2011 blood drive, and they remind us that the need for a safe and secure blood supply is always with us. If healthy and qualified, do your part and donate blood. In doing so, you protect not only yourself, but the community as well. Remember, the greatest gift you can give is the gift of life. This important message is a courtesy of the Merchants National Bank of Sacramento, member FDIC, and an equal housing lender. They're concerned for the welfare of our community. Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. If you'd like to find out what your local free-form student and community-run radio station can offer you at any particular hour of the day, I invite you to visit our website, which is kdvs.org. You will find a greater variety of music and talk here than you will on any other local radio station. But it's good to have a map. So visit our website, kdvs.org, if you'd like more information. Scott Herring is here in the studio. Scott Herring is one of my colleagues in the University Writing Program at the University of California at Davis. He grew up in Burbank, California, near the bullseye of metropolitan Los Angeles. And after receiving his bachelor's degree from Cal State Northridge, he moved to Yellowstone National Park, where he spent 5 years living and working at Old Faithful and elsewhere. He returned to CSU Northridge for a master's degree and then went on to the University of California, Davis for a PhD in English. In 2004, he published the book Lines on the Land, Writers, Art, and the National Parks. And I think that was the last occasion for him to come to KDBS to talk about his work. Scott has made an academic specialty not just of the national parks, but of all writing on the natural world. Among other courses, he teaches for UC Davis classes such as advanced writing, writing in education, as well as writing in the health professions. He's a jack of all trades, but we're going to talk specifically about the ways that writing interacts with not only technology, but his love of the national parks, especially Yellowstone. Scott Herring, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. So I want to talk specifically about a project that you've been working on for a while now, and that concerns your former home of Yellowstone National Park, but which also has some technological elements in that it's online. So why don't we start with that? Could you tell us what that project is?
Yeah, this is a project that began last summer. I began writing for a website called YellowstoneReports.com. Very simple URL, www.YellowstoneReports.com, .org. Oops, I forget. I think it's .com. It is something that has been needed for a very long time, because if you turn on Google or Bing and you search for Yellowstone National Park, what you will get is tourist garbage.
Right.
You will get hotel reviews. You will get explanations of when Old Faithful goes off that are incorrect. And there has long been a crying need for a site for serious aficionados of the park, who in fact number in the millions. And this is the first real, almost the first real effort to do so.
That's great. And let's remind folks, if they want to, if you're not driving, if you're driving, keep both hands on the wheel. But if you are home and you have a computer there, then you too can visit YellowstoneReports.com. And you can find out more about the work that Scott Herring, my guest, is talking about.
And if you follow the list of links across the top, there is, in fact, one of the, I believe it's the, let's see. There's a sample reports link at the top. We have, in an effort to try to survive in a part of the world where there is no real economy, the founder of the site has decided to charge $20 subscription rate. However, we put reports online. In fact, I'm writing a series right now that we're going to put the whole thing online, because we think, I hope it will cause a little anger. And so we're going to make that one open. But normally it's $20 a year to subscribe. It is well worth it. A large volume of information about wildlife in the park written by experts, and I mean serious experts, people with PhDs in wildlife biology who have direct experience with bears, wolves. Actually, the founder is a man named Nathan Varley, who's the son of John Varley, and is currently earning a PhD in wildlife biology. He already has a BA and an MA, and he knows a wide variety of species and is especially an expert on wolves. As you may be aware, wolves were reintroduced into the park in 1995, a series of captive packs were brought in from Canada and turned loose into the park, and have become the source of a great deal of hullabaloo. But the site is partly devoted to tracking it tracks the wolves the way kids track NFL teams. among other things. It features photography, and they have hired me as sort of the resident humanist. I comment on social issues. I have some expertise in the archaeology of the park. I have a little expertise in the history of the park. I have a great deal of expertise in the sociology of the park. And a great deal of expertise in the literature of the park, the formal literature of the park. Few people, for instance, know that Rudyard Kipling visited Yellowstone in the 1880s and wrote a hilarious account of his ridiculous trip through the park. But that's what my dissertation was about, and that was what the book that I published, Lines on the Land, was about.
Now, Rudyard Kipling was there in the 1880s. Can much of what he saw then still be seen today in terms of that which has been protected over the decades since?
That will spark an argument, particularly if you sit down at a bar in a place like Gardner, Montana. I think it is essentially identical. The populations of some animals have changed. It is not clear whether they have changed according to natural orders, the natural order of things, or whether manipulation has changed them. To give a minor example, the number of beaver is smaller than it used to be. But these are relatively minor. What Kipling describes is virtually identical to what you will see today, except that he was hauled around the park by horse in a traditional Western stagecoach. And today you do it in a car. That's a big difference.
That makes sense. Scott Herring is my guest. He is a lecturer in the University Writing Program here at UC Davis, and he's written a book in 2004. It was called Lines on the Land, Writers, Art, and the National Parks. And now, since last summer, he has worked on a project called Yellowstone Reports. If you want to find out more, you can go to yellowstonereports.com. So, did you approach the website? Did they approach you? Did they already know about you? How did you two get to know one another? And how was it decided the scope and the purpose of the reports for the website that you would write?
We're sort of making it up as we go along. I have friends up there because, let's give a little background here. After I got my bachelor's degree, you know, I had a bachelor's degree in English. If you get a bachelor's degree in English, you really need to have a plan. And I did not have a plan. I worked at Toys R Us. I worked in the Barbie aisle. I was the Barbie expert. I steadily went insane. In the end, I finally so lost my mind that on a whim, I took a job in Yellowstone and fell head over heels in love with the place. I actually worked for the automotive services company, which was perfect for me because I had been, as an English major, I was a cliched English major. I was terrified of cars. I didn't know where to put the oil, for instance. I worked for that little company for 5 years before I went back to get my graduate degree, but because of that intense immersion in the place, I still have friends scattered around the area. One of them is a man named Mike Tursek, who is an ecologist with a PhD from Tulane University, who studies crucial issues in the park, and he's friends with everyone. He didn't introduce me. We've only corresponded by email. He said that Nathan should consider my work. I have an ongoing Yellowstone journal that actually has now passed about 500,000 words. So I just plucked a couple thousand words out, sent it to him, and he put it online immediately, and we went from there.
That's great. Well, I know that when Stephen King got his big book contract after Carrie, they said, we want three more books, and he said, I'll bring them right over, because he had written a great number of books, which he had put in desk drawers. And so I guess that, you know, it's almost like you're the Stephen King of Yellowstone. You had been writing and writing and writing about the place, And finally, you came across the perfect opportunity to share some of your old work, and I'm sure you're new, with an audience that cares about the place that you do.
Oh, I've got a book ready to go. It's on PDF. Heck, I'll email you a copy if you want one.
Excellent. Are you talking to me or to the listeners?
To the listeners.
All right. So if you'd like a copy of that book, you can email me at aojones@gmail.com or Google Andy Jones or the website of this radio show, which is poetrytechnology.com. And I'll make sure you get a copy of Scott Herring's most recent and no doubt, if not soon to be, eventually to be published book on Yellowstone National Park. We're going to take a quick break. I have more public service announcements to share with you, and then we'll be right back with Scott Herring and more of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
If it were easy, everyone would do it. It takes a special person to join the National MS Society's Bike Tours to Fight MS. If you like a challenge and want to have some fun for a good cause, call 1-800-FIGHT-MS.
This is Dr. Andy with an important message. The Merchants National Bank of Sacramento is proud, as you might already have heard, to join the 2011 blood drive. And they remind us that the need for a safe and secure blood supply is always with us. If healthy and qualified, do your part and donate blood at the hospital or blood bank of your choice. Remember, the greatest gift you can give is the gift of life. This important message is a courtesy of the Merchants National Bank of Sacramento in Sacramento, member FDIC, and an equal housing lender. They're concerned for the welfare of our community. Scott Herring is my guest. He's a faculty member at University of California at Davis. He's the author of the book Lines on the Land, Writer's Art, and the National Parks. And he's here to talk about his new project. He writes for a website, which you can visit, called YellowstoneReports.com. And we're going to hear now from Scott an example of what you might read if you support this website. What's the title of that piece, Scott?
I ended up calling it The Airing of Grievances.
Great.
Reasons that will become clear in a moment.
Great, let's hear it.
A little background. The National Park Service made a decision that surprised everyone to destroy the old visitor center at Old Faithful and replace it with a new one, which ended up being gigantic. And all the locals were infuriated. So I'm writing a series now, a four-part series, on the reaction to the visitor center and also on the a kind of general building spree that has happened in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Park, which are usually considered to be one and the same. And this, I thought before I let them have it, I would begin on a more happy note. So this is what a typical Yellowstone report sounds like, for me anyway. The naturalists write differently. The airing of grievances, in which our author celebrates Festivus with the National Park Service. Festivus was actually over a month ago. Celebrated on December 23rd and based on the famous Seinfeld episode, Festivus may now be well known enough to not need much explaining. It is, of course, the alternative Christmas celebrated by the Costanza family and includes among its traditions the airing of grievances, in which family members take turns letting other members of the family know how much they disappointed the complainant this year. We have so far on this website gone pretty easy on the National Park Service. It is time for that to change, given a certain shift in philosophy that has overwhelmed the service over about the past decade. As the resident humanist here on Yellowstone Reports, I think it is my duty to lead the airing of grievances against the service. But I want to approach this carefully. I have long since grown sick of people slamming the National Park Service indiscriminately. Hang out in a border community like Cook City, Montana, and you can hear the whining all winter long. We have to be realistic. It is only occasionally that a mammoth federal bureaucracy is going to behave in ways that please everyone. As a Gardner, Montana resident once said to me, anyone with any intelligence at all will inevitably disagree with the NPS about something. Of course, she is always in a rage about the NPS, but still. Well, let's try this. Before I launch the airing of grievances, let me tell another story, one with a happier ending. Early last spring, we drove through the north entrance to the park, my son and I, and ended up at Old Faithful. We were curious about a highly unusual feature at a geyser basin called Black Sand Basin. It had undergone a violent steam explosion recently, and the event had been more or less accidentally recorded on film. We wanted to know more. Even though I know absolutely that one must never enter a National Park Service Visitor Center because of the noise alone, we went to a series of them and had one grim, horrible encounter with the National Park Service after another. The worst was surely the last. We entered the collection of trailers, yurts, and hovels that served then as a temporary visitor center at Old Faithful, the former visitor center having been nuked as part of a new upgrade plan for the Old Faithful area. I picked the oldest ranger, usually the best bet. We waited a long time and got to listen to the rangers answering questions. They were in the habit of yelling each word individually to be heard above the din, and also because so many of the visitors either spoke a little English, being from overseas, or were suffering interstate highway deafness. The scene and even the specific questions were brutally familiar to me. No! If you want stamps, you need to go to the post office. The brown ones were probably bison. They were not milk cows. The bathrooms are outside where the bathroom signs are. The questions go on hour after hour. Paul Schuleri, one of the premier writers about Yellowstone, in his memoir of working at the VC, the Visitor Center, says he longed for a sophisticated nature question, but in my experience, these people are beaten senseless by the questions they answer. Another hammer blow to the head. When a difficult or unusual question comes, our ranger is too stunned, too bone dumb from the pounding he has gotten to do anything with it. I also think he or she simply does not usually know the answer, either having just arrived from Yosemite or Everglades, or simply not being interested in the subject. When our turn finally came, I explained about the unusual feature at Black Sand Basin. I made it clear that this involved both experts and photographic evidence. Our ranger, he had huge earlobes like Dumbo, stared at me as if I had asked about a mud and rock feature on Neptune. And here is an absolutely direct quote from him. I know where Black Sand Basin is. Don't know nothing about no rock. He then stood staring in the deadest, blankest silence, a signal on his planet that it was time for me to leave. We gave up on Black Sand and Basin and walked through a random tour of the upper geyser basin, the large geyser basin of which Old Faithful is a part. The sky was gray as a dead fish, spitting rain occasionally and occasionally dumping frigid little loads of snow. The temperature kept dropping, the wind picking up. Still, when we passed Riverside Geyser, my son, a better geologist than I, could tell from both the prediction board that the National Park Service had set up and from T. Scott Bryan's famous geyser guidebook that the geyser would erupt in an hour. It happened to be the only major predictable geyser that he and I had never seen. A bizarre omission, but there you have it. Gradually, and despite the still deteriorating weather, a substantial crowd developed. The lee side of the trees that grew next to the pavement did provide some shelter. Into this scene, a young ranger naturalist bicycled up. A young woman and cheerful, despite the hammer pounding she had taken at the temporary visitor center. She altered the prediction board with a grease pencil and jovially promised an eruption within a half hour. People now arrived in twos and sixes and fours. At least half were small children, remarkably small. Their average age may have been five. One had a green raincoat with a hood in the shape of a frog's head. Another, maybe 4 years old, walked up to the ranger. "Does a geyser," he asked, "feel happy when it erupts?" The ranger improvised with skill and without a pause, as if she got that question as often as she got the one about where the bathrooms are. "I think we feel happy when a geyser erupts." On the spot, she invented a geyser lecture aimed precisely at a kindergarten level. In the end, she had a platoon of tots imitating a happy geyser, making a loud whoosh, and doing physical onomatopoeia with their arms, flaring them upwards to make a happy eruption. The crowd, now a solid 50, was charmed silly. Just when you think you cannot stand the National Park Service for another minute, you meet one of their better people. Now, next time, let's talk about the new Old Faithful Visitor Center.
That was great. It sounds to me like Yellowstone Reports should also include a podcast of these being read by you and perhaps some of the other authors.
That would be neat. And we are, you know, we're putting it together as we go along, as we can, as, you know, as we add people. We need a fish biologist. If you are a fish biologist and wish to volunteer, give us a call.
All right. And when you give us a call, you can drop an email to me. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Or to my guest, Scott Herring, H-E-R-R-I-N-G, who, like myself, is a faculty member at UC Davis. Scott Herring teaches classes, writing classes primarily in advanced nonfiction writing, writing in education, and writing in the health professions. And Scott, tell us one more time the title of the website where one can find your work.
It's simply Yellowstone Reports, yellowstonereports.com, www.yellowstonereports.com, and it comes up first on Google. I actually have not yet seen a hit counter, but I think it is beginning to grow with some speed and health.
Excellent. Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the radio show this afternoon.
And thank you, too.
Absolutely. Well, folks, I'd like to remind you that tomorrow, another one of our colleagues, Amy Clark, will be introducing authors who took part in a new anthology called The Twilight Mystique. Jim McElroy will be there. Mary Jane Osborne will be there. Other authors will be there. I'll be there, and that'll be at Bistro 33 tomorrow afternoon at 5:30. If you want to find out more, you can Google Twilight Mystique. It's also a brand new book. I will be back a week from today, and then a week from tonight, I'll get to introduce Hannah Block, the great poet, translator, and scholar. If you want to find out more about this show, you can go to poetrydavis.com. Otherwise, stick around for great music, and I'll see you next week for another edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry.